Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgebeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgebeer.
Hello and welcome. The dangers of psychedelics have occupied the news headlines for decades, but over the last 10 years, with celebrities and entrepreneurs openly sharing their life-changing experiences and respected scientists and universities researching the therapeutic benefits of psychoactive substances such as MDMA and psilocybin, for people with anxiety, depression, PTSD, and terminal diagnoses and trauma-related issues have changed the picture. But less well known are the wisdom-bringing psychedelic experiences of many top psychologists, psychiatrists, researchers, and others who have taken what they learned from their entheogenic experiences and applied it in their professions, leading to therapeutic advancements, scientific discoveries and healing for thousands of people. With me today is clinical psychologist, host of the Mind, Body, Health and Politics broadcast, and author Dr. Richard Lewis Miller, whose latest book, Psychedelic Wisdom, The Astonishing Rewards of Mind-Altering Substances, shares stories of psychedelic transformation, insight and wisdom from his conversations with 19 scientists, doctors, therapists and teachers, each of whom has been self-experimenting with psychedelic medicines, Sub Rosa, for decades. Dr. Richard Lewis Miller, welcome.
Thank you, Sandy.
Now, you've been a clinical psychologist for more than 50 years. You founded the internationally acclaimed Cokeenders Alcohol and Drug Program, and you've written several books on psychedelics, including Psychedelic Medicine, Psychedelic Wisdom, and the yet-to-be-released Psychedelic Psychotherapy and Sex Unveiled. Tell me, what first inspired your interest in this arena?
Well, I was in Michigan, at the University of Michigan, where I was on the faculty, and I was reading about the experiments that were going on at Harvard with Drs. Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, and I followed that with some great interest, and then they published a book called The Tibetan Book of the Dead. And in the back of the book, there was a recipe for taking LSD, in which it said that if you cannot get LSD itself, you can ingest a certain kind of morning glory seeds, heavenly blue or pearly gates. And if you ingested enough of these seeds, you would get a psychedelic experience. And so being an experimenter in the mind and studying the mind, and I was so impressed by the work that they were doing, the early work, because there was a lot of interaction going on between us and the faculty at the University of Michigan and Harvard, that I was wanting to get involved with what they were doing. So I went out and to the local feed store, and I bought out all the heavenly blue and pearly gate seeds that they had, and went back and created a little setting with a good friend of mine, Alan Pinsance, and we each ingested 400 morning glory seeds. And it was not easy getting 400 morning glory seeds down the esophagus, but we managed to do it. And had a most remarkable experience. It was life changing, really. I saw the pyramids in the making. I went back and actually saw people living in caves way before the time of the pyramids, and I was taken on a really voyage, a very relatively rapid voyage throughout all of history, And I came away with the very strong impression that everything that has ever been known is in the DNA of every one of us, and that the answers to the questions that we may have and the guidelines to how we best behave are all inside of us. So rather than be looking outside of us for answers, whether it be in the great books or somewhere else, I was directed to look inside. And the other thing that happened was I had a very strong sensation that we are not animals, beings living on the earth. We are beings that are part of the earth, that the entire planet, it came to me as one living, breathing organism, and that we are basically cells, if you will, along with all the other animals and all the parts of nature, are simply parts of this one extremely large, from our perspective, but small in terms of the perspective of the universe, that we are all parts of this living, breathing organism. Just as cells on our body are parts of our body, we are just parts, little tiny parts of this breathing organism that we call the planet, the Earth. And I also had this very strong impression that all human beings are connected in some physical, chemical, spiritual, whatever name you want to give it, way, that we're all very strongly connected to one another. And so it changed my worldview. It changed how I connected with other human beings. I suddenly felt, rather than alone, a person living in the world, I felt part of the world, and I felt connected to everyone else in the world. So how I then addressed everyone, it felt like I was addressing more of myself to myself, like each of us was part of ourselves. So that was how I initially got involved. It was through that experience, influenced by Leary and Alpert's work at Harvard, and my having the youthful courage to eat 400 morning glory seeds.
Wow, I expect there'll be a run on those now.
I don't know if they're available anymore.
You must have been really disappointed then when, they got arrested and put in prison.
Well, of course, I thought Harvard made a huge mistake in kicking them out. Mm. I think what Harvard needed to do was put a large arm around them and bring them into the fold and give them a way to do their research, but in a way that Harvard would be comfortable with. I think when you excommunicate people, it always causes a problem. And when you excommunicate people of great brilliance, you run the risk of what exactly happened, which is they became cheerleaders for a major movement.
Yes. Yeah, indeed. So in the years between then and now, how much activity have you had with psychedelics yourself?
On a personal level? I've taken upon myself to experiment with just about every substance that is available for both psychedelic research, but I've also taken it upon myself to experiment with the many substances that my patients have gotten themselves involved with, because as you pointed out in the lovely introduction, I'm a chemical dependence treatment expert, and many of the substances that my patients take are not psychedelics, and they're not particularly consciousness expanding, but they are substances of addiction, such as cocaine and heroin and opium. And I've experimented with those as well, just to see what the feeling is like that my patients are experiencing, as well as some of the, I've experimented with some of the pharmaceuticals, not all of them, but with some of them. I say not all of them because some of the pharmaceuticals, in order to have an effect, you have to take them every day for weeks at a time in order to get the effect. And I'm not willing to put myself in that kind of position. But the pharmaceuticals that are fast acting and that you take and then they're out of your system within a day, I've certainly tried. And I've tried all the major psychedelics, which are the more of what are personally interesting to me. Well, personally and professionally, of course.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously we know that a lot of drugs have side effects that have to be dealt with, and some of them can be life-changing. I don't know, does this apply to psychedelics? Are there ongoing side effects that people experience?
Well, you have to take the, that's a big question, because you're referring to a whole class of molecules, psychedelics, and each one is different. I'll take them one at a time if you'd like me to.
Yeah, as long as we do it in short bursts, because
okay, in short bursts, LSD.
Yeah.
No known side effects. No mortalities. We don't have any deaths on record. I interviewed the foremost scientist on the planet, Dr. Dave Nichols, on this very topic and asked him directly. And there's no known mortalities from LSD, even with people who have taken doses that you think would send them to another planet, but they don't die from it. MDMA, there are increased cardiovascular effects, heart rate and blood pressure. And so MDMA is not advised for people who have any kind of cardiovascular problems. Other than that, it's a relatively safe substance. The same for psilocybin. There are some increases in heart rate and in blood pressure, but not requiring an additional medicine in order to bring the rate down. In other words, the increase is within reasonable parameters. However, again, not necessarily recommended for people with cardiovascular problems. So those are the main three. And then there's ayahuasca. Ayahuasca we know somewhat less about. It's very powerful. I would again say that anyone that has cardiovascular issues needs to be extremely careful, if not avoid these substances altogether. Other than that, from what we know, they're all relatively safe. And again, one caveat I would add, which is you need to look at what the person brings to the substance. There are people who have certain kind of emotional issues that are deep and going back in time, those people may not be candidates. You want a person who is relatively well put together, the average person, not the aberrant person to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. What is the state of legality with all of them now?
Well, that is a very sad topic, Sandy, because the United States, well, I'm going to go back. In 1935, the Secretary of the Treasury, Andrew Mellon, of the famous Mellon banking family, appointed his nephew, Harry Anslinger, to be the first head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. And Anslinger was an ardent racist. And so what he did is he took it upon himself to use his position as head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics to attack people of color. And he went on a rampage to make various substances illegal so he could arrest people of color. He arrested Mexican people for the use of marijuana. He arrested people, black people, for the use of cocaine. and he arrested Chinese people for the use of opium. And he did it in a vicious way. And all these years, we're talking about 1935. So now 85 years later, we are still feeling the effects of this one man, Harry Anslinger. And this is very important historically, because it teaches the public, Sandy, that one person put into a position of power can have an extremely negative effect, not only on a country, but on the entire world. Because as a result of the United States making these various substances illegal, LSD was made illegal in 1967, MDMA was made illegal in 1985. As a result of this, the United States then went on a rampage with Harry Anslinger going to the United Nations and pushing to have countries around the world make these substances illegal. Now, the effect of making them illegal was so powerful, and this is the point I'm getting to, that university researchers, my colleagues, at the highest levels of university research around the United States and around the world were not allowed to do research for 50 or more years. There has been an abyss. And any scientist who would try to do research without the proper permission, which was very difficult, if not impossible, to get, could lose their license. And any doctor such as myself who would give one of these substances to a patient would risk losing their license and their livelihood forever. And that's the world that we've been living in. And this program that Anslinger went on, it did go on around the world. And I can tell you one side story. Some 15 years ago, I went to Israel with Rick Doblin, the founder of MAPS, and some other scientists with the idea of bringing MDMA to Israel to use for PTSD with their people who were suffering greatly because of the amount of terrorism acts that were going on in Israel. And regular citizens were being subject to seeing body parts right in their restaurants from explosions. So we already knew that MDMA was very positive in treating PTSD. And Israel was a progressive country, and we thought this is a place where we could use it and really do some good. The head, the very top of the Supreme Court in Israel, put her arm around me and said to me, "Richard, we would love to use MDMA for PTSD. We've seen the research. We know that it works. But I've got to tell you that if we were to do that, the American government would sanction us, and we can't do it." And this was still the effect of Harry Anslinger starting in 1935. And I was in Israel, and this story occurred after the year 2000.
So where are we today?
Where we are today is there's a renaissance that's going on because some scientists, many of those who I wrote about in my first book, Psychedelic Medicine, kept pushing the government for permission to do a little research. And Roland Griffiths at Johns Hopkins University did some breakthrough research some years ago demonstrating that psilocybin was very effective in the treatment of depression. That research was breakthrough and it had ripples around the world. And so that was the beginning. I and my program that you referenced earlier, Mind, Body, Health, and Politics, over the last 15 years, I did the longest series of interviews on psychedelic science that had ever been broadcast in the United States. So I contributed to that renaissance with the broadcast. As a result, the laws are starting to move forward and loosening up and allowing research. The other thing that's happened, Sandy, is that there's been a very strong, active renaissance with regard to marijuana, which is leading the way. So Harry Anslinger managed to put over a million people in jail as for minor marijuana offenses. A very high percentage of those people are people of color. It's really a reprehensible behavior that has been going on, something we all should be ashamed of. What's going on now, though, is that 35 states in the United States are now allowing some form of marijuana, either medical marijuana, recreational marijuana, or both. The marijuana was the entrance point to loosening up of some of the laws with regard to allowing research into the psychedelics. Then a few cities started to change their laws. So the city of Oakland, California is now allowing things that come out of the ground, such as psilocybin mushrooms and ayahuasca, to be used in research and to be used medicinally. San Francisco has really recently followed suit. The city of Denver, Colorado. So we have three cities that are allowing substances that come out of the ground to be used both recreationally as well as medicinally. And the state of Oregon has changed their laws. So there's a bit of a breakthrough. At the same time, the United States government is allowing more research, so the scientists are jumping on board. In your country, you've got a person named the Countess Amanda Fielding in her, with her research foundation, which she courageously started, called the Beckley Foundation. And they have been pushing scientific research. David Nutt works with her, and they've done some fantastic work. Amanda Fielding published in the New York Times pictures of the brain, an MRI of the brain on LSD, and the same brain without LSD, showing how the brain literally lights up when a person takes LSD, therefore allowing the possibility of very enhanced cognitive functioning. That was breakthrough research. You all can be extremely proud of the Countess Amanda Fielding and what she has done, not just for England, but for the whole world, in leading the way in this psychedelic renaissance.
I have to say that her chapter was one of my favorites. And I especially was fascinated by what she shared about glucose and vitamin D. I mean, none of which I knew. And I'm sure a lot of other people don't know that, but they will now.
Yes, they will now because of her courageous work throughout her lifetime.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, dosage is a major issue, isn't it? And I mean, she goes into that quite a lot. And you have quite a dialogue about the correct kind of dosage and what happens, you know, if somebody's going to flip out or something. I guess dosage is one of those issues that is being used too as a means of control, because if you can't control the dosage, then it could be very dangerous to some people.
Well, what we have here, Sandy, is we have substances which at the very same time are drugs and medicines. The exact same substance can be used as a drug or it can be used as a medicine. And what differentiates is the protocol. The protocol. When you get up in the morning and you've got a bottle of something and you open it up and take it and you have no idea what's in it because you bought it off the street, that's a drug. When you go to a professional person and you go through a procedure where there's an interview beforehand, and then there is an invitation to a special place, a special setting, and you are administered a dose that is exacting because the dose has been provided by a chemist that is made in a professional laboratory and administered by the professional, then you know exactly what you're getting, and you're getting it in a special way along with treatment. No one is suggesting, certainly not myself, quite knowledgeable in these medicines, no one is suggesting that any of these psychedelic substances are substances that you buy, take, and all of a sudden you have a magical panacea. No, these substances need to be taken in a special setting along with a person who's going to give you psychotherapy both before and after. So it's a combination of the therapy and the medicine which is so effective. It isn't simply a matter of just taking a pill and all of a sudden you get a cure. And the public should know that. That's very important. And of course, what you're saying, Sandy, about the dose is critical. But the only real way you can know what your dose is if you get the medicine in a professional situation. Because when you're dealing with illegal substances and you get them off the street, you have no idea what's in the bottle or in the pill or in the powder that you're taking. It's a mystery and it can be dangerous. And that's what's happening in the United States right now, where we have over 50,000 people a year are dying because they think they're taking OxyContin and they're getting fentanyl with it and they're dying from it. And it's an epidemic.
Yeah. Does gender and weight, is that a factor when they're calculating the dose for somebody in a clinical setting? Do they take gender and weight into consideration?
It depends on the medicine. With LSD, it's not relevant. With MDMA, it's more relevant. With ayahuasca, it's considered not as relevant. But that's a topic of great interest that we need to learn a lot more about, and we will with the research. Because if you're taking something that's in the bloodstream, that can be affected, of course, by the weight and the volume of blood of the person. If you're taking something that goes right to the neurotransmitters, you know, neurotransmitters are not as are not affected by your height and your weight.
Interesting. Alcohol,
of course, is very affected by your height and your weight because it's in the blood. Yeah.
We're going to take a short break now, Richard. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and my guest today is clinical psychologist, founder of the internationally acclaimed Cokeenders Alcohol and Drug Program, host of the Mind, Body, Health and Politics broadcast, and author of several books on psychedelics, including the one we're discussing today, Psychedelic Wisdom, the Astonishing Rewards of Mind-Altering Substances. And we'll be back with more from Dr. Richard Lewis Miller after the break.
Om Times TV. Imagine becoming a super influencer. Reinvent yourself, invest in your brand, and then manifest your success with a robust, spheric approach. Om Times Media and Broadcasting offers a unique and multifaceted way to become the spiritual and conscious influencer you deserve to be by putting your message across our powerful platform with its proven record of integrity and excellence. Through our produced shows, Om Times offers the opportunity to become a social media TV personality, a radio show host, an Om Times magazine columnist, and a syndicated podcaster, all in one shot. By live streaming your show on Om Times TV and broadcasting it across the extensive Om Times radio and TV networks, you become more than a host. You become an ambassador and a force for positive change. Om Times. Open yourself to the possibilities.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of Om Times flagship radio show, What Is Going On? And as an author, editor and 13 times book judge who's read thousands of books and interviewed hundreds of authors, I'm constantly asked what's really worth reading and what's not. So I created the No BS Spiritual Book Club to help you save time and money by picking the brains of discerning names who have walked this path before you. There's no catch, no fees and no BS, just an ever-growing library of 10 best spiritual book lists from some of your favourite authors and teachers, plus free book excerpts, audios and video interviews with people like Don Miguel Ruiz Jr., David G., Lee Harris, Mark Nepo and more. From well-known classics to hidden gems you've never heard of, it's the only No BS guide to the best spiritual books to enlighten your journey of self-discovery. So why not join the club? Get inspired and save money at the No BS Spiritual Book Club.com.
There are 16 million children struggling with hunger in America. That's 1 in 5 daughters, sons, neighbors, and classmates who don't know where their next meal is coming from. Yet billions of pounds of good food go to waste every year. It's time we do something about it. Feeding America is a nationwide network of food banks that helps provide meals to millions of kids and families in need. Visit feedingamerica.org to help them feed even more. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're feeding America.
Welcome back. Dr. Richard Lewis Miller, in his book, The Immortality Key, The Secret History of the Religion with No Name, Brian Rurarescu explores the role that psychedelics have played in the origins of Western civilization and how sacred beverages were routinely consumed as part of the ancient mysteries. What do you know about that?
Well, I know that we have been altering our minds in many ways since the beginning of time. We alter our minds by spinning, was called whirling dervishes. We alter our minds by taking mushrooms, which we have evidence people have been doing going back thousands of years. And of course, we've been altering our minds with the substance that we call alcohol. In fact, I've read that during one period in English history, the entire country was drunk for a period of 100 years, from the poorest person to the king. Because when people discovered the effects of hard spirits, and they started laughing, and their moods were elevated, they thought they found the fountain of youth. They found the fountain of life. You just drink this liquid, and all of a sudden you're happy, and you're feeling good, and your pain goes away. And so it caught on. When Benjamin Franklin went to England in the early 1700s, I think it was roughly 1763, he discovered that the English were drinking beer for breakfast. They actually were drinking the porridge that the beer was made out of. And when he asked around, why are people drinking alcohol? Why are they drinking beer for breakfast? He was told, because we don't trust the water. The water is potentially dangerous, but beer is safe. So he found himself surrounded by people who were drinking beer for breakfast, beer for lunch, and beer for dinner. And it was like he looked around, it seemed like everybody was drunk to him all the time. And it's a cute story about it, but what he did by not drinking the beer and taking a risk with the water was he was able to save up enough money to make it back to the United States. Because when he went over there to buy a printing press to bring back to Philadelphia, because he was a printer. But when he got there, he had been tricked and he didn't have any money. So he went to work as a printer, saved his money by not buying the beer, and then made his way back to Philadelphia. But the short answer to your question is, it seems part of the human condition that we like to change our consciousness, whether we change it to expand our consciousness, to learn more, or we take it to diminish our consciousness, such as painkillers, such as things like heroin or OxyContin. But some people say it's a search for a mini vacation. Others say it's a search for other universes. In my own case, it's a search for what's inside, for what can I find out about this inside, all the information that I call it being a kind of travel agent, and I specialize in inner space travel. And it's fascinating to me. I don't have to go anywhere. I can just take a substance, close my eyes, and the whole universe is available to me. Literally, the whole universe seems available to me. It's very difficult, Sandy, to explain to a person who hasn't taken a psychedelic what it's like to take a psychedelic, because the experience is so out of context. It is so different from anything, even close to anything, that we all of us experience in everyday life. It is a whole different paradigm of experience.
Yes, I can imagine. I haven't taken any serious psychedelics, so I don't know. But everybody says that. And I think we all need to bust out of our normal paradigm and experience something different in order to expand our thinking.
The expansion is one part. The other part that's so important, Sandy, is the healing of trauma. So many of us have been traumatized in some way in our childhood. And that trauma affects our daily lives. It affects how we interact with people. It affects how we perform at work. It affects how we interact with our children. It affects how we continue the trauma sometimes by not knowing better, because there's an expression, hurt people hurt people. And so people who have been traumatized often traumatize other people. And one of the most powerful aspects that these psychedelics offer us is the potential to heal trauma and to make things better for the next generation rather than continuing the trauma.
Well, I love the research that's being done now that's showing, people end of life, people who have got a terminal diagnosis, people who suffer from incredible anxiety and depression, and people with trauma and PTSD are actually finding relief and joy again by taking something like psilocybin.
Yes. In fact, I'm in contract now to write my next book, called Grateful Death, End of Life Healing with Psychedelics. And I'm focusing on the very topic that you just brought to our attention, which is dealing with these end of life transitions. Because as we all know, so many people are anxious and depressed as they enter the end of life transitionary period, because there is an almost universal fear of death rather than accepting it as part of the life cycle, that we're born, we live, and we die. And rather than being able to go into this transition that we call death with an acceptance and a peace and a celebration and gratitude for the life that we've lived, too many people go into it with a tremendous amount of fear and anxiety, which debilitates them towards the end of life and makes their end of life painful and uncomfortable.
Mm. I was in Canada about 3 or 4 years ago with my sister, who had been diagnosed with terminal cancer. And every time she asked one of her oncologists, well, what do you think about taking cannabis or something? You know, most of them just waved it away. Oh, there's no evidence. There's no evidence. A couple did say, well, you know, if you want to try it, I'm not against it. And there were certainly some clinics that you could go to. And if you could show that you had a diagnosis, you could buy some of the products. This was before they completely made it legal.
Yes.
The challenge she faced was getting consistency in the product. You know, she'd buy one particular product, cannabis, and take it, and it would work really well. But another one that looked exactly the same and had the same label on it didn't.
Exactly. And that's what I was referencing earlier in our interview today, Sandy, when I said When the government makes things that people are using illegal, then people have to buy it in the black market, and then there's no consistency. You can't get an exacting dose. That has changed now. In California, where I live, for example, you can actually buy pills of marijuana telling you, and it looks just like a regular bottle of pills that you get with any other pharmaceutical, and you know exactly the amount you're getting. But what a sad situation for people like your sister and so many millions of others who have to buy it on the black market, and you really don't know what it is you're getting. And even with something that grows out of the ground, you cannot tell. And that's true, by the way, for mushrooms, for psilocybin as well. There are many strains of psychedelic mushrooms, and you cannot be sure when you weigh them on a scale, just because the weight is the same, that the power of the molecules is the same. This is something that really needs to be taken and done professionally.
Yeah. What are the biggest myths about psychedelics?
The biggest myths? Well, you know, we had this campaign in this country of disinformation, where people were told that if you take LSD, you're liable to jump off the top of a building. We had some famous broadcaster in this country named Art Linkletter, who was famous on the radio. And he said that his daughter took LSD and jumped off a building. And then they spread information that if you take LSD and look at the sun, you're going to become blind. And, oh, this guy, Harry Anslinger, spread all these stories about, it wasn't about psychedelics. He said about cocaine, that if black people take cocaine, they go on a rampage raping white women. I mean, the disinformation has been incredible. And the unfortunately, the government, our United States government, has gone along with it now, as I said, for over 50 years. And it's really time for a change. They're not representing the people. They're representing their own jaundiced views, which are so often influenced by corporate pharmaceutical companies. Because the pharmaceutical companies are very threatened by this psychedelic renaissance. For you see, if you can take one dose of psychedelic mushrooms and a year later still have a positive effect on your depression, that means you don't have to take the pharmaceutical medicine every single day for 365 days. I mean, basically, the pharmaceutical companies are getting an annuity. They've got people hooked and they have to take the medicine every day for the rest of their lives. There's no such a thing as a healing and a cure. And we need to do something about it. It's high time. I'm very happy that I'm living to see the time that, look, the changes are coming.
Well, the door's open now, and there's so much research coming out that I don't think we can go backwards anymore.
Well, I certainly hope not. I certainly hope not, and I hope you're right.
There's enough info. I mean, Michael Pollan's Netflix documentary series, so many people have watched that. He's educated, enlightened, and inspired many, many people. So I think now there would be a little bit of an uprising if they did try to go backwards.
Well, I hope you're right. Michael has done a great deal of good, both with his books and with that Netflix movies. And I'm pleased to hear you're seeing that movie over in England. I don't have any idea of how far it travels around the world.
Yeah, we've got it here, and I know many, many people. You know, we do not have, it's not, nothing's legal here. Many people who have children, who have awful seizures, are fighting to get it medically prescribed. CBD is on sale, but you can't get THC. But I think that they are beginning to look at the research. And there is some great research being done at Imperial College with psilocybin. I've seen TV programs on that. So I do think that we're definitely moving forward on this.
Well, I'm very glad to hear it. You know, we had something fortunate happen in this country, which is that a family who had a child who was having convulsions at the rate of about 100 a week, living in New Jersey, heard about the use of CBD, and they couldn't get it in New Jersey, and they moved to Colorado, where they were able to get the CBD, and they administered the CBD to the child in Colorado. And the child went from having close to 100 convulsions a week down to one or two a week. And a famous medical broadcaster named Sanjay Gupta on CNN heard about this. And he traveled to Colorado, and then he did a program on it. And his own views of the use of medicinal marijuana changed. And as a result of that, he got on the program to have marijuana made legal for medicinal purposes. And this was very helpful as well. So when things like this happen, when somebody wakes up to the fact that we have real medicinal potential and that somebody has a lot of influence, that helps the cause as well. But we still have very strong sentiments and people, particularly on what's called the right side of the aisle in this country, who are rapidly, you know, anti anything. In fact, they seem to be anti everything, but particularly anti substances. And we have to deal with that because they are stopping the wheels of progress and still attempting to have people put away.
A lot of people are looking at microdosing. They're looking at it to become more effective, to raise their mood, you know, increase their cognitive abilities, etc. What would you advise to anybody who is considering taking you know, a drug or, you know, microdosing or something?
Well, first of all, I'd advise that they read three books. There are three books that are, or three or four maybe, that are worth looking at. One, of course, is Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind. That's a personal history. Then there's Jim Fadiman's book, Dr. Jim Fadiman. He's a friend and a colleague, The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. And that's the recipe book. That explains how to take microdose, you know, and what kind of protocol to use. And then there's my book, Psychedelic Wisdom, which are the scientists who have done the actual research. So if you look at those three books, you've got the personal, you've got the recipe, you've got the scientists, you've got a lot of information. If you want a fourth book, which is also personal, specifically on microdosing, then I would say Iolette Waldman's book, which is called A Really Good Day. And the four of those will give you a lot of information about the microdosing and psychedelic science in total. In a nutshell, what Jim Fadiman's book is recommending is if you're going to microdose, you microdose and then you go 2 days without, and then you go 1 day on and 2 days without. Microdosing is what you might refer to as a homeopathic dose of a psychedelic substance. It is so small that when you take it, you don't know that you've taken it. So that if someone were to have given it to you, which nobody should ever do, but if someone were to have given it to you, you wouldn't know that someone had given you something because it is subsensate. If you notice something, then it's no longer a microdose. Then it's moving into a dose, but it would be a very tiny dose. And we have evidence so far. Jim Fadiman has collected thousands of stories from around the world of people who have microdosed. And we do have evidence that it helps with regard to focusing on tasks, slightly enhances the mood. It's a tiny mood elevator, and if you will, an energizer. And then people are experimenting now. A microdose, by the way, is 10 micrograms. 10 micrograms. So if a very small dose of LSD, but to get a psychedelic effect, if a small dose is 100 micrograms, then you can see how 10 micrograms is a small amount of a small amount. So it's really, there is no psychedelic effect. It's not like you take it and you feel anything whatsoever. So we're doing, there's more experimentation that is certainly needed. But if Amanda Fielding's research is teaching us something, what the microdose must be doing is energizing parts of the brain, but certainly not as much as the amount, as the energizing or the oxygenation, I should say, that was achieved in her study, which was, I believe, 100 micrograms of LSD. That research of Amanda's, by the way, is really worth, anybody who's seriously interested in all this is worth looking at because it's a profound piece of research.
Mm. So you've got two new books you're working on. One is Psychedelic Psychotherapy, and I assume you'll be looking at how you know, psychedelics are used in a clinical psychotherapeutic setting, and also Sex Unveiled. Now, does psychedelics come into the Sex Unveiled?
No. Psychedelics doesn't come into Sex Unveiled. This is another part of my history. When I was just setting up my clinic in San Francisco in the 1960s, I happened to meet a woman named Margot St. James, who was a famous madam, and we got to be friends. And she really educated me about the world of prostitution. Margot went on to become a international activist for what are referred to as working girls. They were referred to themselves as working girls. And Margot started something called Coyote. Coyote stands for Call Off Your Old Tired Ethics. And what Margot is wanting to do is legitimize working girls, legitimized prostitution. And what Margot taught me when I was still in my 20s is that men are able to use their brains, men are able to use their bodies, physical work, men are able to bring to bear their entire beings as a way of making a living. But women aren't. If women use a certain part of themselves, namely their sexuality, as a way of making a living, they are shamed, they are stigmatized, and they are thrown in jail. And this is part of a program or a cultural effect that's been going on for thousands of years, whereas men have been subjugating women and not allowing them equality in the world. And when Margot taught me that as a young man, it had a profound effect upon me. And so that topic has been on my mind for a long time. And Sex Unveiled, which I have dedicated to the working women, of the working girls, if you will, of the world, is my way of making a small contribution towards allowing women their rightful place, not just to be able to use their sexuality, which of course I believe they should be able to use, but to be able to use every other part of themselves. And what I discovered, Sandy, in doing the research for this book, is that women have not only been subjugated sexually, but their enjoyment of sex has been subjugated. So that just as there is a differential in economics, whereas a woman who has the exact same merit as a man gets paid less, it turns out that around the world, measured in the United States, women are having fewer orgasms than men. Roughly one third of the women in the United States are orgasming, whereas men are able to orgasm somewhere into the 90s. And this isn't, and then we have all this theory about why women aren't orgasming. They're frigid, they have this kind of problem, and they're stigmatized as if it's the women's fault, as if there's something wrong with women, or they're mentally something, or they're hysterical. And it turns out that's not the case. The reason women are orgasming less is because they're being subjugated and put down for their sexuality by men. If a man has sex with a bunch of women, he's a stud. If a woman has sex with a bunch of men, she's what? She's a whore, or she's a nymphomaniac, or she's a slut. We slut shame her. So there's all this stigma that's attached to women if they do the very exact same thing as a man. So it puts women, you females have been traumatized almost from the time you were born about your sexuality. And that has been on my mind since Margot taught me that in the 1960s. And this book, Sex Unveiled, is my small attempt to make a contribution to enlightening the public about this really terrible phenomenon.
Well, thank you for that. I'm really going to look forward to when that book comes out, and we will have another conversation about that, because it is a very, very important conversation. We have to close now. I have one last question for you, and I'm afraid it's going to have to be just a one-word answer, and that is sex better with psychedelics?
Yes.
Thank you, Dr. Richard Lewis Miller. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure, Sandy. Thank you so much for having me.
Me too. Psychedelic Wisdom, The Astonishing Rewards of Mind-Altering Substances is published by Park Street Press, a division of Simon & Schuster, and is available wherever good books are sold. And believe me, this is a very good book. And for more information about Richard Lewis Miller, his books and broadcasts, visit mindbodyhealthpolitics.org and psychedelicmedicinebook.com. That's it for this week. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'll be back with you at the same time next week. Till then, it's goodbye from me.